Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and Vice Chancellor for Global Health at UNC, about international health from Ebola to HIV. But first, we have some research that matters, some good ones today, Adam.
We do, Christy, but I do also want to acknowledge that you're back with us. You've been doing a lot of things, and you're involved in some leadership things at UNC Healthcare, and we've had a couple guest hosts, so welcome back to Your Health, and I'm really excited about our guest today. You know, the issues of Ebola are really all around us, and I think we're all exploding with questions, so to have Dr. Cohen here, an international expert, really in our backyard, is a real privilege.
Yes, a very relevant and timely topic today.
But we do have some good research that matters today. We're going to be talking about adolescents and teens and antibiotic prescribing by physicians.
About salt and blood pressure.
About something called neuroticism, and we'll even find out if that's a term that's still used in its relationship to Alzheimer's.
And about the pros and cons of efforts around hospital crises with the elderly.
Let's talk about our very first research that matters, which is a study that was in the journal Pediatrics recently about antibiotic prescribing for kids who come in with upper respiratory and sinus infections, and how often this occurs, because we know there is a problem.
Yeah, we know that doctors and nurse practitioners overprescribe antibiotics for children, and we also know that 23,000 Americans die each year related to antibiotic-resistant infections. So this is a problem, but how big of a problem is it?
Well, this particular study, they looked at 18, a whole group of studies that were done on youth 18 and under, published between 2000 and 2011, and they estimated that 27% of kids who come in to see the doctors actually have infections that could well be bacterial-related, but they found that 57% of the time when they came in, the doctors prescribed antibiotics. And this is one of the first times they've actually been able to kind of look at how often the bacterial infections actually may be there when they come in, but find that the prescribing is much higher. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think, for one, it's a beautiful way to look at this, to see, okay, for ear infections, sinus infections, upper respiratory, throat infections, what is the prevalence, what is the percentage, and then how often they get antibiotics. I think it's relevant. It's good for us to know and sort of hammer in how much we do overprescribe. And for our listeners, it's good for us to get the message out there that you don't need an antibiotic every time your child has an illness, and it's important to have that conversation and bring it up with the doctor so that they know that maybe you're not looking for an antibiotic, you just want to do the right thing for your child.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's easier when we look at the research than when we get in the clinical examination room, and sometimes it's more difficult when we get in the examination room. Even if we say, you know, 27% of the time it's bacterial, that may be enough to threshold by which many family doctors and primary care doctors would say, you know, that's still high enough that I think I should prescribe. But I think perhaps sharing these decisions with our patients actually could open up new conversations, and maybe that may lower the inappropriate use of prescribing.
Well, we've talked before about the benefits of delayed antibiotics, and so that can be something that we can bring up as well, of giving a prescription and allowing parents to follow it for a few days and then determine whether or not that antibiotic is even needed. So those are some things patients can bring up to the doctor.
Well, let's talk about this next research that matters. And this is an interesting article that we've talked some about the issues of redefining salt and high blood pressure. And this is an article that was in the American Journal of Hypertension.
It is. They looked at about 8,600 French adults and really looked at this relationship between salt consumption and systolic blood pressure. And really what they found, big picture, is that salt consumption was not associated with systolic blood pressure in men or women after they controlled for age and other things.
Yeah, we do know that those who have hypertension consume foods with much higher degrees of salt, and this was done in France. I don't know about the French fries, but I do know that a lot of people eat French fries around the world, and salt and potato chips. But the data on salt has become much more complex, and as you and I know, we've talked on Your Health a number of times in the recent past that this relationship between salt and high blood pressure and the limitations we're doing may or may not be the right advice.
Well, there's mixed evidence as we look at the value and the relative value of salt and its relationship with blood pressure. We do know that alcohol consumption, age, and weight are big factors that go into having high blood pressure. And so, I mean, there's mixed information. I think take home, if you have high blood pressure, cutting back on salt is probably a reasonable thing, and it might help your blood pressure a little. It probably will. But cutting back on alcohol and losing weight definitely will make a difference.
Yeah, I think so, and even some data on fruits and vegetable consumption leading to lower blood pressure. So perhaps we're focusing a little bit too much on salt and not enough on primary preventive aspects that are known to lower blood pressure. More to be determined. What about our very next research that matters?
Well, I think this is an interesting study related to Alzheimer's. So we know that we don't know very much about what causes Alzheimer's, and we've talked several times on the show about different studies and different ways to look at the factors and any factors we can change that relate to the development of getting Alzheimer's.
This particular research was in the journal Neurology. I think we would understand that that's a respected journal, the Journal of the American Academy of Neurology, and it looked at 800 women from Sweden who were at the age of 46 and followed for 38 years. First off, any researcher that can follow a group of people for 38 years, I'm willing to bow down to and say, good, well done.
Absolutely. Well, they looked at elements of personality traits and reaction to that and defined a few things that I'll go over quickly. Neuroticism, which sounds like a bad word.
It actually, up until the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the psychiatric literature that defines these elements, is moving away from that term, but it really just means negative emotions in response to adverse things that happen in one's life, which I think are common, but people who have adverse emotions and reactions that persist, that's a difficult problem.
So in their study, they defined it as being easily distressed and having personality traits such as worrying, jealousy, or moodiness, and expressing anger, guilt, envy, anxiety, or depression.
And just one little thing, those actually symptoms, neuroticism in the literature, has been really strongly linked to adverse physical and mental health, lots of mental health conditions. So this is a serious issue.
And they also looked at introversion versus extroversion, if you're more shy and reserved and process things internally versus being more outgoing like extroverted people are, to see what sort of relationship that and stress might go into having Alzheimer's disease.
And what they basically found is that by scoring these women and then following them for this period of time, that the women who had the highest on the test for neuroticism had double the risk of developing dementia compared to those who scored low. It didn't appear to be related to this introversion, extroversion, though. If you're introverted and you had the higher levels of the neuroticism, your risk was the highest. I think this is interesting, and what do you think?
Well, I mean, that neuroticism doubling the risk did was linked and dependent on having long-standing stress during that time. So, I mean, I don't know. A lot of this is association and not causal, and so we have to be careful not to say, okay, I need to quit my job and walk away and give up everything so I don't have stress so that I won't get Alzheimer's disease. We don't want to overreact to these sorts of associations, but they contribute to our knowledge.
You mean I can't go to my chair tomorrow and renegotiate?
I'd love to. It sounds like a dream.
But I do think there's this element here of mindfulness, and we can, you know, there's very little downside to mindfulness and meditation, and perhaps our role as providers and our listeners' roles is to bring more attention to this type of meditation.
And the final research that matters today is on high-intensity hospitals and their efforts to save elderly after surgery.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal called Surgery, and basically it looks at this kind of trade-off, this downside between what happens when you are having surgery towards perhaps the end of your life, serious surgeries, and you have complications, and the efforts that are made to then rescue the patient compared to hospitals that perhaps aren't quite as aggressive.
And they found that patients who had surgery at what they defined as an aggressive hospital were 5% less likely to die of a major complication, but had much higher Medicare costs, stayed in the hospital much longer, were more likely to die in the hospital versus at home, and were less likely to get hospice as a part of their end-of-life care.
And I think there's a trade-off here.
Sure.
And it reminds us to remind our colleagues, to remind our patients, and to remind us again that we should be focusing on the things that we can prevent potentially these serious complications, to decrease in clots after surgery or infections that may occur, keeping people mobile, and then reducing medical errors. These are things we perhaps can intervene in that maybe have much more impact than trying to then rescue after a serious complication.
I completely agree. Complex issues, but those resources could be perhaps put more towards prevention. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and Vice Chancellor for Global Health at UNC, about international health from Ebola to HIV. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Chief of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina and Vice Chancellor for Global Health at the University of North Carolina, about international health from Ebola to HIV.
Welcome, Dr. Cohen.
Good morning.
We are grateful to have you with us today as an expert in the area of infectious diseases, and wonder if you would share with us a little bit about your story. What sparked your interest in infectious diseases and spurred you on to such a rich career?
Well, I was in medical school. Everyone has to choose a specialty, and people kind of find their mentorship and their way, and I got particularly interested in infectious disease, partly because I thought there'd be no math. most of the other specialties had some math, and I thought this is something, you know, that would be great for me. And then in my training, I was at Yale in training, and I had the chance to go to China for a year. And that was catalytic in terms of working in other countries and in other cultures and getting interested in broader aspects of the specialty.
You know, I know we're going to move quickly into talking about Ebola. It's impossible not to with what's all the world that's happening. But I wonder if you could just give us a sense in your career, what are the epidemics, the things that when you first started out, some of them that you've seen and experienced that, you know, at the time you thought, wow, this could be really serious, and boy, it did turn out that way.
Well, one thing about the infectious disease, there's not that many infectious disease specialists. There's only 4,000 in the United States. So it's a small club compared to cardiology or GI. The meetings are small and people know each other in public health and medicine. And we leave time at our national meeting, which is tomorrow. We leave whole empty days for whatever disaster happens. So if you're a cardiologist, you know, you don't have an empty day. You're going to talk about, you know, stints. But for infectious disease specialists, we assume something really bad is going to happen. This year, we have a whole bunch of bad things to fill in our empty time. So for me, when I first started, my first day of medical school, a little bit later, we were still managing people with polio and iron lungs. So we were just at the very end of the polio epidemic, and, you know, and that ought to kind of be reflective today as we deal with enterovirus 68. Subsequently,
which is
the enterovirus 68 is the organism which is circulating around the United States, causing an unusual constellation of symptoms, including respiratory symptoms. Normally, you think of enteroviruses as causing diarrhea. And now we're seeing respiratory symptoms, and we're also seeing some children with paralysis called acute flaccid paralysis. That evokes this whole memory, in my mind at least, of polio. Then the next thing that happened in our field was Legionella. And so for all of you, that's become a humdrum, but then that was a huge thing in infectious disease. Why were these men in Philadelphia acutely ill dying of respiratory infections? And for years, that was a dominant feature. And then the mother of all pandemics came along, HIV. In Chapel Hill, you would think, interestingly, why would people, and I was at UNC for the whole time, most of you weren't born when I started at this university, and you would think, why in this little town would we have a very large epidemic of HIV? In 1985, 15% of all our admissions were for HIV. More than a quarter of our hospital budget was related to management of HIV. How did that happen? It's because in the 50s and 60s, we tended to become a hemophilia center. And so unbeknownst to us, the blood supply became contaminated with the virus HIV. It infected our hemophiliac patients, and then we in Chapel Hill ended up managing a huge number of patients with HIV. And that then became a dominant theme of research for the infectious disease specialists here.
And as we reflect, I know we want to talk about Ebola, but we can't help but reflect on HIV and AIDS and sort of how far we've come and the difference of the experience, both in efforts in prevention and in treatment, for what we see now compared with what happened in the 80s. Could you reflect for our listeners a little bit about what happened and the big changes?
Sure. Well, first, we ought to really learn a lesson from HIV. The most important thing, we're always going to have new microorganisms causing problems. We need to know the rules. When HIV first came along, we didn't even know that AIDS was caused by a virus. So we needed to learn all the rules. But before we learned the rules, there was the kind of fear and stigma we now are seeing with the Ebola epidemic. So the first issue is fear. People are very afraid of infectious disease. They run out of the room. Everybody who's seen Ben-Hur, the movie, remembers it's not really good to have leprosy in the Middle Ages. So people are afraid of infectious diseases. And so first we needed to understand the rules. What caused this disease? How was it transmitted? And what were the strategies to prevent transmission? That really changed everything. That was the first thing. Then in 1988, through work done in North Carolina, the first drug was developed that took people who were inevitably going to die. This is AZT. Everyone died before that. 100% mortality. AZT was life-saving, and that's 1988. 1996, we got triple drug therapy. We realized we needed more than one drug. 2006, we got all the drugs in one pill a day. 2012, 13, we now see about 14 to 18 million people on treatment, and in our own work, we were able to show that treatment renders people no longer contagious. So the treatment served as prevention, which became a national mantra. And now in 2014, we see the movement towards two movements. We see increasing progress in vaccine development, slow but steady, and we see the Cure AIDS movement. And the Cure AIDS movement is dynamic and compelling. And so we go in a very short window of time, 85, a brand new bug that just discovered, 2015, a person detected with HIV and treated effectively early in disease lives a normal lifespan. No change in their life. Easier than having diabetes. So the state of North Carolina, our partner, their whole campaign is get tested, get real. Get tested, if you're positive, get treatment. In the United States, treatment's immediately available to everyone.
You know, with HIV, it's kind of interesting. What you've just reflected is, of course, my experience and perhaps many, if not most people's experience, which is you may have known someone or had a family member or friend who had and died of HIV 20-plus years ago, and then you may know a whole host of people who are living with HIV who are really pretty well, and we're seeing them as family docs in their locations. But we have this new illness, we have this new disease that, not so new, but is yet sprung on us, and that's Ebola. And I guess there are three things that I think we could really talk about. The physical, the real issues that are happening, what's the social elements that then come up, and then ultimately what's the narrative. But maybe we could just start with, what are the physical things that people, you know, the myth from the facts that you think are really essential for people to know?
Well, probably the most important thing about Ebola right now is we don't know all the rules. Okay, so nothing makes us more anxious than we're dealing with an agent where we don't know the rules. Once we know the rules, everything changes. And so we're trying, and there was a paper in the New England Journal last week, really summarized by my colleagues at Imperial College, where I spent last week, actually in London. And that paper tells us about the current outbreak and summarizes the time from exposure to presentation of symptoms and characterizes the symptoms and gives the clinician a pretty clear idea of what this looks like. In addition, the management of patients with Ebola in recent months has clarified what things can be done for supportive care that might reduce mortality from 70% down to 40 or 50%, which is a big difference. So part of this is understanding the clinical presentation and preparing people to recognize Ebola. And the most important thing would be the medical history along with the epidemiological history. Remember, for infectious disease specialists, we ask three questions about the host, the environment, and the pathogen. So we hope that everyone asks about the host, the environment, and the pathogen. And the environment, obviously, in this case, is entirely critical.
But let me ask you a quick question here. These symptoms of early Ebola, we're about to be in flu season, endemic. And it appears to me that the symptoms overlap within the first 24 hours of symptoms a lot with flu.
So I don't think so.
How do we differentiate those as providers and as a community? How do we do that?
Infectious disease specialists hate calling things the flu. Okay, that's a net. We also hate the word compromised host because we divide people up into categories. Right? And so for us, influenza is a disease characterized by high fever, sudden onset of myalgias, coryza. That's quite different than high fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and bloody vomit, and bloody diarrhea. And, you know, very quickly, when people start vomiting up blood, it would be pretty hard-pressed to say, you've got the flu, take some Tamiflu.
Yep.
I'd be shocked if that happened. So I think that the...
So it's a constellation, not a single symptom.
Yeah, this constellation, the fever... Fever is a ubiquitous thing that brings people's attention. But then very quickly, the kind of constellation of signs and symptoms are different. And then the travel history becomes critical. I think that as you're now seeing patients, and we certainly have signs all over this hospital saying, stop, tell us if you've been to West Africa or if your relative's been to West Africa. So... we're also worried, by the way, our field has many fears. We're talking about Ebola. Remember, we're also worried about the Hajj and MERS-SARS. You'll remember SARS hasn't gone away, and MERS-SARS is a disease that appears to be carried by camels that can also be transmitted to humans, and the Hajj is irrelevant to us.
We can pick back up on some translation of that for our listeners after the break. We do need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue with this fascinating conversation with our guest, Dr. Myron Cohen, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina and Vice Chancellor for Global Health at UNC, about international health from Ebola to HIV. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking to Dr. Myron Cohen, Chief of Infectious Diseases and Vice Chancellor for Global Health at the University of North Carolina, about international health from Ebola to HIV, and had some really interesting questions about perspectives in historical, but also really now with Ebola, ways of understanding risk and some of the constellation of symptoms.
And you were just helping tease out for us not to be too afraid as we discern the difference between, quote-unquote, the flu, as the flu season happens, with signs and symptoms of Ebola, focusing on travel and some of the other symptoms. But I wonder, as we're dealing with the other element, the social element, the fear, the stigma, the animosity towards other countries, perhaps, that have this virus and are bringing it into our country, how do you summarize that, and what do we do about that?
For us, as I keep saying, I know it sounds mundane to say the rules. We need to understand the rules. So we have, we come to believe that the transmission highest during a window of time. This becomes, for the United States, a big national event, because currently we only have a few places that have been kind of certified to take care of Ebola patients, but that's not going to be enough facilities. So other experts and facilities are going to need to understand a lot more about personal protective equipment, about how to maintain patients properly, about what supportive care can be given, and about how to eliminate the probability of transmission. We must make transmission zero.
And what we know now is body fluids and...
Yeah, well, we're quite certain that the exposure to contaminated body fluids is essential. Okay, what we don't know is inanimate transmission. You know, what happens with secretions that have been lying around on sheets and such? We think that that's low risk, but we don't know that it's zero risk, and we're trying to understand that. We don't completely understand time of maximal contagion and minimal contagion and no longer contagious.
Like although, how long somebody needs to be exposed to that?
No, not so much that. That's a good question. The efficiency of transmission is a rule, but are people... At what point do people become contagious, and at what point are they no longer contagious, and how contagious? What's the probability of a transmission event that have the potential of preventing replication of Ebola? All three agents have been deployed on an emergent basis, and we're trying to understand prospectively, do these agents work? So there's no time for double-blinded randomized controlled trial. There's deployment of what is. The sedafivir-like drug is made in North Carolina by a company called Chimerix, and that's been deployed, as you know, in the patient in Texas. The antibodies are being generated at the highest rate possible, and there's another drug available that inhibits RNA. So all three drugs are being deployed. So what's going to happen? We're going to see this thing move faster than in the history of the species. Okay, this will be the fastest deployment of prevention and treatment strategies ever. Because of the nature of the virus, I personally, this is my opinion, I'm very optimistic that one or more of these things will work. How well they work, we're going to determine when they need to be introduced. But the animal models that are available suggest that these things are going to work. And so what we're seeing is, because of the magnitude of the epidemic, we're seeing emergent deployment inconsistent with how we normally develop vaccines and drugs. So from my point of view, that seems totally appropriate to me. And there's meeting after meeting about the ethics of this and about the metrics that need to be measured to determine what works and what doesn't work. But it seems like the species is doing its very best to interrupt this terrible pandemic. Having said that, this is going to go on for a very long period of time. So we at UNC and all the other major medical centers like this are not thinking this will be gone in a month.
Well, you know, one of the pieces that clearly needs to occur is this community engagement, really with any epidemic management, of how one engages a community in doing the things. And could you speak to a moment about how the CDC, how the infectious disease community, how the public health leaders, our policymakers, what do we need to be doing about community engagement, both here in the United States, but in Africa, and the systems we need to help improve that?
Well, there's global engagement, and you see in the newspapers the concern that it was too slow. Okay, there's almost no one who believes that the pace was correct, at least retrospectively, for what transpired. Along the lines of global engagement, you see that the U.S. has deployed supportive troops, not as military conquerors, but to help with infrastructure that doesn't exist. So now we're at the phase of infrastructure and building trust in communities where if you go into the hospital, you never leave. Okay, so this is a big issue. When we first, and some of you in this room will remember, when we first had HIV testing, no one wanted to be tested. Why would you want to be tested? So you could lose your health insurance and lose your family. Now, if you have Ebola and you go to a facility where you've seen the pictures in the New York Times, where there's almost no resources available and there's certainly no specific treatment, there's not a lot of incentive. We need to build incentive, and that's what's going on right now.
And so along with that, how does the international community communicate with each other as you have new discoveries, as we're sending in people, and how does the communication work in building that global community?
We have a service called ProMed, which many, many times a day tells us everything bad on the planet. So if you really want to be afraid, if you want to be afraid, in the last 8 minutes we'll look at ProMed, and they'll update us on the number of cases, the number of deaths, and a lot of other things.
You could just summarize that for us. That's okay.
No, I mean, ProMed is a way we communicate with each other. And that is a very active service for infectious disease and public health experts. Beyond that, we count a lot in communication with the World Health Organization, the UN, the CDC, and the NIH.
About using mobile technology and particularly trying to reach the public, and I read specifically about this West African-based tech company, Code Innovation, working with some Israeli technologies to create this app called About Ebola and to customize it to really influence tribal leaders in communities to then spread these types of messages. Mm-hmm. Amazing, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think you'd be what's amazing. I remember in working so much in China when we were still having like whatever our we were having landlines. They didn't have any landlines. They had cell phones. I mean, people in Africa, they jump our technologies. It is obviously a resource-constrained place, but at the individual level, people will buy the state of the art. And so they have a lot of iPhones and cell phones, and they will use those to communicate. And you're getting back to the point of changing the kind of expectations in a terrible situation, which are pretty important to change very, very quickly because of the exponential growth of the spread of Ebola. Right now, we're still in an exponential spread time, right? The growth rate is what we call it. Again, we get to math. The growth rate of the epidemic is very, very fast. You saw the CDC estimated that there'll be 1.4 million cases, perhaps in the next few months. That's a lot of cases of Ebola.
You know, one of the things...
In West Africa, by the way. In West Africa, okay. Not in the United States.
Okay. Well, we are about to wrap up our conversation. It's gone so fast, and it's been exciting. One of the messages I hear from you is one of hope, that there is hope. We have a history of figuring out those steps to being able to address this, and that, at least in your opinion, that would be fast. What is your take-home message for our listeners about the next phase?
Mm-hmm. I think there will be cases in Europe and the United States, and they'll be constrained, as has been discussed. It's a terrible thing, but our infrastructure will allow us to prevent epidemic spread at the rate we've seen in resource-constrained places. I think the issue for us will be the deployment. In the next 6 months, there will be discoveries, biomedical interventions and public health interventions that will contribute. And I think the deployment will be very, very fast. It's not going to stop this, but it will slow it down, and it will be an impressive contribution of the kind of global community. So I am sad by what's going on, but optimistic about the strategies that are available to us.
Well, and that narrative of hope, I think, Christy, that you and Dr. Cohen really brings here is one that ultimately may be a new narrative here and a new paradigm. So we really want to thank you so much for coming and sharing your expertise, compassion, and hope with our listeners today.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
Christy, if any of our listeners have a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We've got some really interesting house calls today about someone who continues to have pain after a heart stent, someone who broke an ankle and worried about whether or not they need to have screening for osteoporosis.
Someone with psoriasis and a history of melanoma, and someone taking medication for irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS.
I'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first house call question.
My wife had a heart stent placed last year because of abnormal stress tests. She never had pain before the procedure, but now she has daily pain. We think they did something wrong when the stent was put in. What do you think is causing the pain?
Well, having the stent, and I guess we should define for our listeners some of what are we talking about with a stent, and that is this tiny little tube that can be placed in and left in a heart artery to help with the blood flow to the heart muscle. And sometimes people can have pain associated with just having the stent in their body.
You know, and it raises a whole host of more questions, which is not everyone who has chest pain who has a stent placed was the chest pain due to the cardiac cause or the heart cause of mm-hmm. the problem. And so it would stand to reason that after a stent is placed, that some portion of people will still.
Well, I would want to know, is your wife taking the blood thinners that were probably recommended after the stent placement, and is there a chance that the stent could be blocked? So it's certainly something to talk with the cardiologist about or the heart doctor to clarify and try to tease out what's causing the chest pain.
What's our very next house call?
I am a total klutz. I tripped, fell, and broke my ankle. While I'm only 47, I wonder if I should go ahead and have a bone density screening test done to see if I have underlying osteoporosis. No one in my family has had this, to my knowledge.
Wow, that's a really good question, and one that I think perhaps sometimes I don't think as much about, Christy, when I see someone who, you know, they trip, they break an ankle, they really bad sprain, and think about, I wonder, should they have an osteoporosis screen?
Well, and unless you're at super high risk of having osteoporosis at a young age, 47 is a young age to have osteoporosis, unless you're taking long-term steroid medications or something that might thin your bones or have other risk factors, I don't know that the guidelines would support screening you this young, especially since your fracture came with a known fall and not just sort of happened on its own.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated when you get, they have a magic cutoff in some of these guidelines of 50. So if you're perimenopausal and you break a bone and you're 50, and that's somewhat of maybe an arbitrary designation of someone who's perimenopausal, but I do think this is one of those questions where it'd be a good idea to go in and see your provider and really do a more formal risk assessment, go through all of the different things that may put you at risk. You've only told us about your family history. We don't know about smoking status. We don't know about alcohol consumption, other chronic conditions that actually may raise your risk level. And, you know, we have some wonderful librarians who work with us in the Health Sciences Library. We can ask them to actually put up on our website some links to some of the criteria for help people see about what raises the risk for osteoporosis.
Absolutely. Great question. And we hope that you'll be careful and that you won't break another bone. Thanks for your question.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
My mom has psoriasis and had early melanoma taken out years ago. I read she could benefit from PUVA light therapy, but her dermatologist seemed concerned about melanoma. What do you all recommend?
Well, I think it's a complicated question and a good one, because there are lots of treatments for psoriasis, ranging from topical therapies that are safe to sunlight, to the more intervention sorts of therapies that are done in the dermatologist office, like this PUVA, which is a light-based therapy that has very good outcomes in treating psoriasis.
So if it's mild psoriasis and the topical steroids or the creams can work, then you would want to favor that for her because of that risk of melanoma that comes with the light therapy. And since she's already had a melanoma, that light therapy would increase the chance that she could have another melanoma.
The problem is that the PUVA, or this light therapy, can actually raise your melanoma risk. And so having had a personal melanoma history here, I would share the dermatologist's concerns that this may not be the right indication for you. I think the dermatologist in this case is right on track.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our very last house call question. Erica?
I've been taking Donatol for years for my IBS, but recently my doctor said this medication could be addicting. I certainly don't want to be taking anything I could become addicted to. What do you recommend?
Well, that's a good way to approach things, of not wanting to take things that you could be addicted to, and certainly not wanting to take things that you don't need. So I'd want to know, how often are you taking it? How often do you get symptoms? Have you tried to taper off? There are a lot more questions I'd want to know before weighing in too heavily.
Did you know, Christy, that a little over 30 years ago, Donatol was one of the 25th most prescribed drugs in the United States? So this is an older drug. You may not have been born 25 years ago, but
thank you.
But it is what is oftentimes given in a cocktail. When people go into the emergency room, they get what's called a gastrointestinal cocktail, and this is part of that. And it's a combination drug with several things in there, including phenobarbital. And the phenobarbital can have addictive properties, particularly for someone who has underlying addiction. So I do think it's worth being concerned and talking with your provider.
And perhaps taking taper to take the minimum amount needed for your symptoms. But we appreciate these house call questions, and we thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health, and we want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and get our health app for your iPhone.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, University of North Carolina Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest today, Dr. Mike Cohen, and the live audience that we have today. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.